seated. Our second case for today is 11-AP-2833, State v. Jacqueline R. Robinson. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Robinson is Dustin C. Haskell. Arguing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin is Sarah Lynn Larson.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. My name is Dustin Haskell, representing the defendant appellant petitioner Jacqueline R. Robinson. This case concerns a defendant's double jeopardy protection against a circuit court sua sponte increasing a legally valid sentence. And we ask that this Court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and hold that where the circuit court imposes a sentence that is not premised on any error of law or fact as apparent from the original sentencing record, that the defendant can legitimately expect that that sentence is final and that double jeopardy precludes a subsequent increase of that sentence. The primary interest at stake in this case is finality, and that finality applies to, I believe, all of the parties and the Court in this case. First and foremost, to Ms. Robinson or similarly situated defendants. And the question has been whether a defendant can legitimately expect that his or her sentence is final. And this harkens to the original purposes of double jeopardy, preventing a defendant from the fear, the anxiety of subsequent punishments for an offense that's already been subject to an initial punishment.
And that's very logical, and it makes sense. How does that square with Justice Blackmun, who authored the majority in DeFrancesco, who very thoroughly explored the history of finality of sentencing? And I can't remember the exact phrase that he used, but the paraphrase is, there's a world of difference between finality following an acquittal and finality following a sentencing. And I think he wrote back about writings from 1789 that indicated that at any time during an individual's sentence, they could be brought back for resentencing. Now, I'm not arguing for 1789, but I'm asking you, how does that square with Justice Blackmun's right. Observations.
I agree that DeFrancesco does identify a world of difference between double jeopardy after sentencing and after an acquittal. I think that after an acquittal, double jeopardy is more or less absolute, would prevent any sort of retrial. And what DeFrancesco notes is that there's no per se rule that applies to criminal defendants after sentencing. But the question then becomes whether the defendant can legitimately expect whether or not that sentence is final. And I think that even if there's not a per se prohibition, I think that the case law in Wisconsin, there is State v. Jones, is a good case where a per se rule is perhaps the wrong answer, where the defendant procured a sentence by fraud, by telling the court that he was a Vietnam POW.
Right.
And so a per se rule would be, you know, contrary to good policy in that sort of situation, I think. And that defendant really has no basis to legitimately expect that his or her sentence is final if procured, you know, on his or her own fraud, but that the defendant who is sentenced to what is facially a legally valid sentence and the defendant has heard that sentence imposed and there is no, again, error of law or fact that's apparent from the original sentencing record.
Well, error of fact, that goes to our review, it seems to me, and let me know if you disagree, of a question regarding the factual nature of the deficiency. Now, in your opening remarks, you said that we should be confined to the original sentencing hearing. So I think what I infer from that is you mean that we would have to confine our consideration to what was said at the date of the initial sentencing, but when the judge convened everybody back the following day in this case, he said that he misheard, quote unquote, misheard and quote, misnoted the concurrent versus consecutive nature of the 9 months associated with 0HCM 1636, I believe it was.
I believe that's right. Yes. And so
could we consider that under your proposed rule? Could we consider the next day comments of the judge?
I don't think that in this case, I don't think that the next day comments speak to whether Ms. Robinson could or could not legitimately expect that her sentence was final on the first day. So I think that in this case, the second day comments aren't really relevant to
analysis. But how does that square with our precedent? And I noted, I believe you were in on the last hearing, and you heard some discussion about our being bound by precedent. How does that square with the precedents in regard to cases where the judge made what apparently everyone concedes was a slip of the tongue, said concurrent when the whole record indicates that the whole build-up to the order was this judge was going to order consecutive, and then within a matter of 24 to 48 hours convenes everyone back? So how does that square with your argument that finality, could not be expected?
Yeah, State versus Burt did address a slip of the tongue, and I think that a slip of the tongue is a different case. And perhaps there is a world of an exception where that can exist. Logistically, I see the seeming inconsistency, but I think that there's no slip of the tongue here. That's not what we have that Burt identified was, again, simply a consecutive versus concurrent. I think a pretty simple slip of the tongue that gets made here.
Whereas the slip of the tongue, was it obvious from the record that he always intended one and then said the other?
There's nothing in that.
What record? Burt.
In Burt, there were two things that were noted in the Court of Appeals opinion in that case. First, that the circuit court had sealed his own notes for purposes of appeal, reflecting the fact that apparently a consecutive sentence is what he'd intended always. Burt was also sentenced along with a co-defendant in that case, and I think that's when the error was actually revealed, was that when the co-defendant was being sentenced and received a much longer sentence than Mr. Burt, counsel for the co-defendant objected, noting Burt seemed to be the more aggravated offender, but somehow got the lesser sentence, and so the court had that.
So the error in Burt would appear on the record.
There,
the concept that there was an error.
There is some evidence in the record suggesting an error that's different. In kind than in this case, where we complete the sentencing hearing on May 10th, and it looks like, again, nothing is introduced in the record kind of as a paper record.
Are you asking for a new rule of law, or do you think this rule of law that you asked for, which I wrote down, is that the judgment sentence has to stand unless there's an error of law or fact that appeared on the record or can be derived from the
record? I think that that's consistent with the law that this court in Grootsmacher and the Court of Appeals in all of its published opinions on this matter, they all can be squared together, yes, that there seems to be. Burt is, I think, the closest case, undoubtedly, and in that case, again, there seems to be an exception that the court has recognized for a slip of the tongue, which, again, is not present here. And, again, Burt has kind of, again, those additional factors sort of corroborating the fact of the slip of the tongue.
Well, I'd like to follow up on that. In response to my question, you indicated kind of off the cuff, you said, well, concurrent consecutive, that's pretty easy slip of the tongue. Well, you know, there are several of us here who have sentenced people to prison. And to quote Justice Blackmun, or to paraphrase it, there's a world of difference when you say the word consecutive versus the word concurrent, because you know, as a sentencing judge, what serious ramifications that has. But my larger question goes to this. You said, when I asked you about our previous cases, you said, okay, well, slip of the tongue, okay. So slip of the tongue, okay, but the judge mishearing a case. Now, I counted. There were, I believe, 15 separate references between the ADA, the defense counsel, and the circuit court judge to the 2 years in, 4 years extended supervision, or some permutation thereof. I'm not saying there were 15 references to that exact sentence, but
Sure. They were numerous. I know that, yeah.
But in reading the transcript, I was struck by the fact that the case in contention, the misdemeanor for, I believe, receipt of stolen property, the 08 CM 1636, that the next day became the subject of his comment, his statement, I misheard the joint recommendation. I thought people said concurrent. He said he misunderstood it. And so to correct that misunderstanding, he was going to make it consecutive. So how do we say that there's a difference logically between slip of the tongue and mistake in hearing a case that was referenced one time at the very beginning of the joint recitation? I didn't tote up the number of counts here, but they're conservatively in the double digits.
Right. And so I guess that's where I think what Your Honor is saying is correct, that the record was really replete with evidence that the court was accurately advised of this and did seem to accurately recite what that sentence was. And so I think that all of that fostered in Ms. Robinson the notion that this was the proper sentence.
Absolutely in your favor, yes.
And this was right. And so gave every indication that, again, no error, this is the sentence that I'm going to, in fact, receive in this case.
But to my question, why should we differentiate between slip of the tongue and a judge who takes a note incorrectly about a case that was referenced once?
I think that in Burt, the slip of the tongue, I think, is clearer from evidence that already exists in the record, in part at the time of the original sentencing, in the form of, again, the judge's notes in that case, rather than in this case where we get into, I guess, kind of this hazy area of the judge's indicated on the first sentencing date, a clear understanding, it seems, of the sentences that have previously been imposed, and then on the second day is asserting, you know, a different understanding. And so rather than, you know, asking circuit courts, appellate courts, the state, defense counsel, from trying to wade into, you know, what the circuit court's actual understanding was, what was going on, you know, in that case, I think that a clearer rule benefits all parties rather than trying to, again, assess what the circuit court's real sentencing intent was in this case.
But here, Escobar, don't you think that this court should give some deference to a circuit court judge who comes back the next day and says, gee, I made a mistake. Here's the mistake I made, and tries to correct it. Shouldn't there be some deference?
I think that what the judge has asserted after the fact, I guess first, not particularly, because I don't think that it goes to Ms. Robinson's or, again, any defendant's expectation that the sentence is final, whether he or she can legitimately expect that sentence is final. There's nothing suggesting to her that this facially valid sentence, you know, will need to be revisited. And I think similarly, there are other situations, like situations, where the court does not, you know, find dispositive a circuit court's after-the-fact assertions. I think that in the inaccurate information context, this court noted just in May that, you know, a circuit court's after-the-fact assertion of non-reliance on inaccurate information is not dispositive on the issue. And so while it may inform the analysis in some way if the court, you know, sees fit to do that, I don't think that it is entitled to dispositive weight for sure.
Counselor, isn't it true that if the sentence initially given were kept in place, that your client would receive no additional confinement time for the battery to two police officers?
She was revoked on the premise of this offense, and so that in and of itself, you know, in some ways is attributable to that. So I don't know that she would be, you know, getting off by any means.
She would get nothing. I mean, she got revoked because she broke the law, and that's understandable. But the sentence she had, for which she was initially out and for which she got revoked on, is 24 months in. So if, in fact, the initial sentence were upheld, she'd get no time for battery to two police officers. And it seemed that the judge was concerned about the seriousness of these charges. So is that anything that we should be looking at when we consider whether he really issued a sentence that he meant to issue the first time around?
I don't think so. I think that the plea agreement in this case got sort of mangled. But the original offer was a discussion of concurrent time, which the state would be recommending 11 months, essentially, once you hash out all the concurrent consecutive. And so that would have been subsumed in the revocation sentence anyway. I think that, I mean, Judge Van Grunsven needed to sentence Ms. Robinson on the conduct that was before him and on the defendant that was before him. And if he felt that something above and beyond wasn't necessary, there'd be no reason to sentence her above and beyond. And I think that, again, that also becomes sort of concerning into wading into this, you know, when the seeming inconsistencies between day one and day two is, you know, the court indicates that it wanted to sentence her above and beyond what Judge Domina had done in Waukesha County. But if that had been the court's intent, then it could have done that on day one. It didn't seem like it was doing that in the first place.
To me, that seemed more like a recognition that the judge didn't realize that what he said on day one would give her no additional time, which is when he came back the second day, that's what he spoke to, is that really these were very serious crimes and she needed some time that's associated with the crimes for which he was sentencing her, not the ones.
And I think that, again, if on day one he'd understood Ms. Robinson to be serving 2 years and 9 months, if that's what he asserted, then she wasn't, if he gave her 2 years on that first day as he did, he still wasn't serving time, or she still wasn't serving time above and beyond that.
I was really just looking at it as more an evidence of what his intent was initially. In other words, did he really sentence her the first time around as he intended to sentence her? And you know, I may be wrong, but I had taken his conversation about adding this additional time so that she would really spend 9 months in addition to what she already had for these crimes as evidence of the fact that he didn't sentence her according to what he intended to do the first time around. And I'm not looking at the numerical number, but rather that there should be a consequence to her additional to what she already had for these particular crimes.
Right. And I guess I see the conversation that you and I are having as maybe indicative of the need for a clearer rule. Instead of trying to, again, hash out what happened on day one, what happened on day two, what was the real sentencing intent, and I think that instead closing it off after the court has imposed this legally valid sentence provides a clearer sense of what's going on. And it's consistent, again, with a defendant's legitimate expectation of finality, whether a person in that position could reasonably conclude.
You wouldn't want to stop the courts from resentencing, though, because judges also reduce sentences when they say something incorrectly, and that certainly wouldn't be a benefit to your client and other defendants in a like situation, right?
No, I mean, again, if a new factor comes up, then the defendant can raise that. But I think if the court said, you know, consecutive but meant concurrent or something like that, if that's kind of the hypothetical going down, then double jeopardy doesn't, you know, come into play in that situation, as
Counsel,
there's no constitutional prohibition.
You've come close twice to answering the question that I really want you to answer, and that is, what is the rule of law that you want us to give trial courts so they know when they can pull somebody back in and when they can't? Is it that as soon as the record is closed in that case and the defendant's leaving the courtroom, it's done? Done, it's final, and you can't come back no matter what? Is it that Burt applied? Because to me, Burt is different, and Jones outlined different factors. And those factors kind of muddy the waters a little bit, right? I mean, they sort of do indicate you can bring someone back. It depends how long it's been, what the circumstances are. The chief referenced if it seems clear in the record, but there's no real tether to time in that. I want to know what it is that you want from this court so then I can figure out whether there are any issues with precedent. And then I want you to address whether or not precedent has to be limited somehow or overruled in order to give the rule of law that you want us to clearly provide to trial courts.
Right.
In doing so, just in case I lose you at some point, I want to ask you this too. From the perspective of who? The defendant, as to whether the defendant thought it was final, or from the perspective of sort of an objective review of the record sometime in the future as to whether it seemed like it was final. So think about those things as you're giving me this rule so I know where we're looking, because it seems like it moves a little bit. Is it, oh, gosh, it seemed in the record like the judge meant this.
Okay.
Well, that doesn't relate to whether the defendant thought it was final. The defendant thought it was final. The moment says, the judge says, here's your sentence. The defendant's gone. They think it's final, right?
Right. And so then the rule that we're advocating for is when, again, the original sentencing record reveals a validly imposed sentence that's not and no error of fact or error of law is apparent from that sentencing record, that when the sentencing is over is the time. When the sentencing is over, that the defendant can legitimately expect that that sentence is final. And as to your second issue, I think that it's a matter of a reasonable, I mean, it is not a specific defendant and whether he or she legitimately expects his or her sentence is final. Because then, I mean, it gets into the attorney could just whisper in your ear, your sentence is final, and that would foster, you know, a legitimate expectation, perhaps. But so I think it's a reasonable defendant looking at this. And that's where we...
When you say it's over, what do you mean by that? Do you mean they called the next case? Or do you mean, I mean, there are times when the clerk hands up a note, you forgot felony admonitions, or you forgot the sentence credit, or... I mean, but it was over. But everyone knows it's not really over.
Right. And I
sometimes
think
records come from the jail. They deserve more credit or less credit, or people don't really know credit. When is it really over?
I think when the case is adjourned, when I think essentially the next case is called. Now, you suggested that felony warnings, for example, maybe need to be given. I mean, that could, because again, we're talking about a reasonable defendant, and so that defendant maybe cannot reasonably expect that the sentence is final. Insofar as they need to bring in the case. I think in DeFrancesco, the case that Justice Gableman was addressing, the question in that case was there was a federal statute allowing increase of the defendant's sentence. And so the defendant was imputed with knowledge of that statute. And so that's why Mr. DeFrancesco had no reasonable expectation of finality in his sentence, or no defendant subject to the same racketeering laws that he was would. Whereas there's no similar statutory provision. There is no, again, other error of law in the court's application of its sentence that would suggest to Ms. Robinson or, again, a similarly situated defendant that the sentence would be subject to a later increase.
Counsel, you've been arguing the double jeopardy and the expectation of finality. An amicus has been filed here that says that limitations exist other than the constitutional limitations that double jeopardy imposes, and that Wisconsin Circuit Courts, according to our case law, are barred from changing sentences upon mere reflection, and that after the fact statements are insufficient to meet this standard by the judge, and the state has the burden to show that after the fact statements are insufficient to meet the standard where nothing else in the record supports the proposition. That's all from the first page of the amicus. Are you prepared to discuss the law set forth in the amicus brief here today?
I can discuss it generally, but I think that addresses, again, the issue of reflection that you mentioned.
Absolutely.
And,
that's what
and
it addresses.
I think that reflection is not really what Ms. Robinson is asserting here and is instead focusing on the double jeopardy violation because the circuit court judge's statements would suggest that there was no reflection. And again, kind of as I suggested, rather than, I think, wading into this case, what the judge's intent was.
Who has the proof on reflection? Do you know that? On reflection. And does it have to be shown in the record? Is the circuit court's judge comment that it isn't just reflection after the fact sufficient?
The statement that it's not reflection, I don't believe that would necessarily be enough. I think that gets to the analogous situation of inaccurate information
that
I mentioned.
So the state has the burden of proof of showing that the judge's change in sentence is not after the fact reflection. What in this record supports that?
Supports that
the state has met the burden of proof.
I don't believe that there's anything suggesting or to meet that burden of proof in this record. I think that there are only the comments of the judge on day two that make any suggestion of whether or not it was reflection. I mean, the judge kind of goes into a resentencing indicating that he wanted to go above and beyond. And it does, I think, kind of sound like reassessing and reweighing some of the factors insofar as he misunderstood a 9-month sentence. But I don't believe that any evidence was introduced into the record at that point that would suggest it was not reflection. His comments, I think, are the closest, again, that we get, his statements that he misunderstood.
I thought I heard you make a comment about 11 months. I didn't understand that. Does that relate to the observation from the court on page 108 of your record? The state indicated initially a recommendation, but that's been altered. But what does that refer to? What is that all about?
That comment about 11 months? The original plea hearing, which was not included in our appendix as it's not particularly germane to the issue at hand, revealed that the original recommendation, I believe, is that the state would recommend two concurrent sentences on the two battery to an officer cases of, I believe, 5 months, consecutive to a 6-month sentence for the narcotics possession, and that both of those would then be concurrent to the Waukesha sentences. I think that finding all of that a little cumbersome, they agreed sort of on the spot at the outset of the plea hearing to kind of scrub that, and the judge himself kind of crossed it out on the plea questionnaire. And indicated, let's just say, the state will recommend concurrent time.
I do want to just point something out. It is part of the record. It's in the state's brief at page 31. That's where the transcript of the original sentencing is. The one.
Same. Right. This is the plea hearing.
Oh, the
this,
plea.
This happened
okay.
at the outset of the plea hearing where they, I think, realized there was a
to
problem.
To borrow a phrase, I misheard you.
No, sorry for that. But I see that my time's up.
Before you sit down, and this will lead into Ms. Larson's argument, the issue in this case is what rule should the court apply in determining whether double jeopardy rights have been violated when, after sentencing, the trial court reopens the issue of the appropriate sentence. Is that right? So what's the rule and how does it apply in this case? And I'll tell you what I've heard from the discussion of the members of the court. Doesn't mean that's what they were saying, but this is what I heard, correctly or incorrectly. One rule could be deference to the trial court. Trial court wants to open it up. Hey, it heard the evidence. It made the sentencing decision. That was its discretion. Nothing is unlawful here of either sentence. Let's go with a deference statement, right? Discretion, and then you just have the criteria for exercising discretion, right? Stated law and facts. Two, you look at the court's motivation. You look at all this from the trial court. Trial court misheard, trial court intended, trial court did it or didn't do it. So the rule is, let's look at it from the trial court standpoint. The third kind of rule is, let's look at it, and I'm sorry, the third rule goes into court motivation. Is what's the reasonableness of the sentence? So if the sentence is reasonable, he's really trying to impose a sentence for all the offenses and not just omit an offense. That goes to what the court motivation is, and it goes to the concept of reflection, right? That he woke up at night and said, gee, I didn't sentence him for attacking the police officer.
Right.
And reflect on that. He says, therefore, my sentence is unreasonable. My motive and intent was to deal with it. So the fourth way, a rule of law, is the these defendant's expectation? Did the defendant, not this defendant, but any defendant in this defendant's situation, an objective standard, expect finality? And that goes to what happened on the record. If it was quite obvious on the record that the court was making a mistake, the defendant can't expect finality. If it's obvious on the record that there's no obviousness on the record that the court's making a mistake of law, fact, then he expects finality. So it's the defendant's expectation. Not only the defendant's expectation, but did the defendant start serving that sentence? Right? That's a factor.
It's a factor. I think kind of how much of the sentence has been served is a factor to consider, yes.
That's under Jones. Okay. But that's under the defendant. And the fifth standard or rule of law you could do is you use the same rules as you use when there's a modification of a sentence. No modification of a sentence unless there's a new factor, right? I mean, these are all rules.
That's a possible. These are things to be entertained, I'd agree.
Right. Okay. So when we question this goes to Justice Ziegler's question when she says to you, what's the rule that we're going to apply? And so these are the five kinds of things that have been thrown out by the court here. That is thrown out, that is discussion. So we'll have to deal with that on rebuttal and with Ms. Larson.
No answer now?
No answer now.
All right, I'll think about it. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Larson, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. If I missed various rules applicable, you will tell us, and if you will tell us which one or ones you support.
May it please the court, Mr. Haskell. My name is Sarah Larson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the state in this appeal. Now, the issue in this case is whether the defendant had a legitimate expectation of finality in her sentence.
So that's the standard.
Yes.
This defendant or any defendant or a reasonable defendant?
Just this case. Just this defendant.
And
this
objectively.
Objectively, subjectively, on the record, just because he says so.
In this case, we have the settled record. In this case, we have the trial court at sentencing. There are three reasons why I think she did not have a legitimate expectation of finality. And the first one is the trial court statement at the original sentencing indicate that it intended to impose a sentence above and beyond what Judge Domina did in the Waukesha County convictions. The second reason why I think she did not have a legitimate expectation of finality is just like the trial courts in Burt and Grootsmacher, in this case, the trial court recognized the sentencing error the very same day of sentencing. It called her back the next morning, and it promptly corrected its error and resentenced her. And finally, the third reason I think she doesn't have an expectation of finality is that there is no evidence in the record that the trial court in this case reflected. There is no evidence, only that this court made a good faith mistake. I would like to read briefly.
What do you mean by reflection?
I'm sorry?
You mean my reflection? I mean, the judge had to say to himself, I erred, therefore reflected on what happened that day, right? I mean, no one sent him a note, right? So it came out of his head, right?
It did.
So that's not reflection, or it is reflection, or what does it mean by reflection?
What we have is the trial court statements at sentencing and in resentencing. And in resentencing, he says, I misheard, I misnoted. At sentencing, you can read the transcript, and the state's attorney is discussing all of the cases that was brought against the defendant in the Waukesha County convictions. There were seven cases. Four of them had 11 counts they were thrown out. There was a litany of cases that was presented before the trial court. And when he's sentencing this specific defendant, he says, with regard to the gravity defense, I will tell you much of what I read.
Where are you reading from?
I'm sorry, I'm reading from the state's appendix. It's a sentencing hearing. I'm in page page 110.
Okay, one moment.
At the bottom.
This is the May 10 initial.
I'm sorry, this is the respondent's brief, page.
No, I know. This is the May 10 hearing.
Yes, I'm sorry. This is the original hearing.
Okay.
He's saying, what I read in the complaint is absolutely despicable behavior. And it goes on, and it talks about what this defendant did at the police station. Next paragraph. There is violence coupled with pure possession of OxyContin, and there is a crime that's committed while on probation. Quite frankly, in relation to your character, this court considers the litany of cases that were dismissed and read in as part of the plea negotiations out of Waukesha.
Counsel, where are you? What line?
I'm on page 111 of the respondent's brief at the sentencing hearing, and I'm on the second full paragraph.
She is continuing to commit crimes. Or I don't know what brought it on.
I don't know what brought this on.
Okay.
But there is violence coupled.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry. Quite frankly, in relation to your character, this court considers the litany of cases that were dismissed and read in as part of the plea negotiations out of Waukesha. And this is important. While everyone seems to say that Jacqueline has turned the corner, I think the history and violations of the state give me great cause for concern. And he goes on, I see her as a threat to society. This doesn't sound like a court who wants to simply slap the defendant on the wrist for what she did. I think you take this court's statement in the sentencing hearing, and you take what the court said at the sentencing hearing, and it totally makes sense. He says, right after the sentencing, I checked CCAP, and I realized I made a mistake. I came back, I called you here, so I can make the sentence that I wanted to on the original day of sentencing.
But to be fair, I mean, and if you disagree with my total that I referenced in my question to your opposing counsel, I counted 15 different times when between the three principals, well, of course not Ms. Robinson, but the two attorneys and the court referencing the 2 years in and the 4 years extended supervision. And I made a note on page 109 of your brief where after the recitation of the stipulated plea agreement, by the ADA, followed by the defense counsel, specifically at line 19 of page 109, the court then addresses Ms. Robinson. Ms. Robinson, what would you like to say? The court does not ask any questions for clarification about what the stipulated agreement was. And do you agree with me that there were approximately 15 times between the three of them that they referenced 2 years in, 4 years of ES?
I agree. I agree that the state informed him of the correct sentence and that the defense counsel informed him of the correct sentence.
And he referenced 2 years in, 4 years extended supervision.
That's correct. And I think if you take that statement alone, that's probably the rub of this case. But if you look at what he said prior to that, and how he was upset with her behavior. And you look at what he said at resentencing, he says, look, when I sentenced you, I talked about how despicable your behavior was. I made a mistake.
That's not what he hung his hat on, though, is it? He hung his hat on, I misheard and misnoted the effect of the concurrent or consecutive nature of the receipt of stolen property.
That, and he also said, it was my intent to censor over and above what the trial court did in Waukesha County.
Okay, thank you.
Counsel, this is, as you say, the rub. Right after you stopped reading, let's go to that next paragraph. And that's the paragraph that starts on, that's on Appendix 111, around line 21. And he says, I consider the fact Judge Domina in Waukesha ordered a sentence of 2 years in and 4 years out after she was revoked. So it's difficult for me to understand how the record supports that he misheard the multiple times that was said 2 years in and 4 years out when he repeated it. Can you, how do you,
how do you deal with that? How can I say he misheard it when he accurately repeated it?
Right. And the only thing that the state can say to that is basically the court's explanation. And I realize that might be insufficient.
Now we're talking about
that. Also in his order and in his resentencing, he talks about the litany of cases. And there were several cases that he was, I'm assuming, writing down and going through. I mean, all I can say is this is the reason he gave, and this is there's no evidence in the record to suggest that this.
Who has the proof here on the issue that we are addressing? Do you have the proof? I guess I'm going to go into the reflection stuff,
okay,
because you said that's the third thing you were going to be talking about and wanting the court to rule on. It's my understanding that the state has the burden of proof to show that there is no after-the-fact reflection.
I did actually try to research that issue as to who has the proof. I could not find an answer. Assuming that it is the state's burden for purposes of this argument, I would say that the state has met that with the court's own statements at sentencing, at resentencing, which mirror what he said at sentencing, and the court's order.
I don't know about misnoting. That's to be discussed. But mishearing I have difficulty with because he accurately repeated it. How does the state intend to prove or show from the record that meet its burden of proof that it was a mishearing?
We just go on mishearing. I would concede that the state can't meet a burden of proving that he misheard it. All we have is, as I said, is his statements at sentencing, and that he also misnoted it.
The only difference in the two, in the revised sentence deals with the count two, so he got an extra 9 months. It all stays concurrent, is that right?
That's correct.
Okay. Here's what my trouble is on what your proof is. I'm looking at page of your appendix. Your appendix, yes. Page 117. Line 9. You started 8. The court. Yesterday afternoon, we had a sentencing hearing involving Ms. Robinson. At the conclusion of the hearing and subsequent thereto, the court did some research, and I realized I made a mistake. I'm going to ask you these questions, but you can answer later. I did some research. Is research reflection, as he reflected? And I realized I made a mistake. The split sentence I proposed yesterday did not reflect this court's intent as far as a fair sentence in the case. And on page 118, line one says, in effect, there was a lengthy record with regard to a number of cases of Waukesha County, and I misheard and misnoted some of the sentences that were handed down. And then it goes to the 9 months. It was my mistaken impression that she said the 9 months was consecutive and tacked onto the 24 months. Quite frankly, a review of CCAP subsequently revealed that, in fact, the 9 months was concurrent. So is that all reflection? I mean, this didn't, snap to instantly, made a mistake. I said concurrent. I meant 60 when I meant 69. And the guy, this judge, and I give him credit. I give him credit for thinking through, once again, a sentence he had obviously thought through in saying, you know, I goofed. I goofed. And so I give him credit for that. I think that's admirable. The problem is whether or not there's a rule against that, the rule of double jeopardy. And the rule that you're asking for seems to me to be the same rule that the defendant is asking for, namely that it's double jeopardy when there was no error of law or error of fact that is apparent from the sentencing record. If there's no such error of law or fact apparent from the sentencing error, then the defendant has reasonable expectation of finality and must stand. Does your rule of law differ from the defendant? That's my first question.
I don't think that this court needs to develop a new rule. I think we have the Grootsmacher case.
What's the rule?
The Grootsmacher case says you look at, in every case, you look at the Jones factors individually. That's the only...
They're not exclusive, are they?
They're not exclusive.
Okay. And what's the point of the Jones factors?
The Jones factors talk about the four of them, and the Court of Appeals has consistently discussed the Jones factor.
Well, the point of the Jones factor, isn't it reasonable expectation of the defendant?
Correct.
And the reasonable expectation of the defendant will be found in the record, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay. So you're really, as I hear it, agreeing with the defendant that the test is reasonable expectation of this defendant, and you can find this defendant's reasonable expectation on the basis of the record.
That's one aspect.
Right.
You also look at Grootsmacher, and Grootsmacher was clear that a sentencing court can modify a sentence if it acts promptly.
Okay.
That case uses the word promptly at least two or three times. And in this case, just like Grootsmacher, the sentencing court recognized the error promptly.
So if they do it fast, that trumps the reasonable expectation of the defendant.
That's part of it.
It's one part of the test.
And okay. I just did want to note, and also in Grootsmacher, this case also considered, this court considered not only what the judge stated at sentencing, but it also considered what the trial court stated at resentencing. That's paragraph 37. So it considered not only what the trial court said at sentencing, but his explanation at resentencing.
Okay, well, now I looked at the trial court's explanation after sentencing, and to me, it fits the dictionary definition of reflection. At the conclusion of the hearing and subsequent, I did some research and realized I made a mistake. It didn't reflect my intent as far as a fair sentence. It was my mistaken, I misheard, he says. I misnoted. On the other hand, he did state it properly. My mistaken impression that it was consecutive and tacked on to the 24. And then I reviewed CCAP, and it revealed that it was concurrent. So, what's your view on reflection, and why isn't this case illustrate reflection? Reflection is not a double jeopardy issue, right?
That's what the court in State v. Scott said. And when I think of reflection, I think of that case where there was sentencing, and the trial court got in his car and drove home and thought, I should have gotten the defendant some more time. So when I think of reflection, I think of when a trial court narrates of what it did. In this case, you have the trial court, I made a mistake, quick, I'm going to go on CCAP, I made a mistake, I'm going to call him back the next morning and fix my error. I don't think what the trial court did in this case was reflection. As it said in the resentencing and in its order, I just realized I made a mistake, and I'm here to fix it. It's not one of the situations in State v. Scott where he's driving home and he thinks, I probably should have given this defendant
counsel,
more time.
Do you have the judgments of conviction?
I do.
There's an amended one, an original one, right? I just want to make sure I have the right record or I'm looking at this correctly. Can you help me with that for a moment? Is the original judgment of conviction dated May 13, 2011? at record 125 and 126. And is the amended one at 127, 128?
Is this the case brief?
That's the Court of Appeals decision, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, blue brief.
Okay, so.
There are the two judgments of conviction, I think. Are there more than two?
What are you looking at?
The judgment of conviction.
Yeah. 125.
Yes, 125, right.
The original one is 125 and 126, right? And that's dated May 13, 2011.
Yes.
Okay. And then is the amended one that was done after the court resentenced or amended the sentence or whatever you want to call it at 127 and 128?
Yes.
Okay. When I look at those two documents, I see that in both documents, the sentence for count one is 3 years, 6 months, count two, 5 years, 9 months, and count three, 5 years, 9 months. In the bifurcated sentence time, it is 18, 24, 33, 36, 33, 36. In the initial document, it finds that the defendant's eligible for the challenge incarceration program or earned release after 15 months. The first one, it says it's concurrent near the bottom, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
The amended one, it looks like, gives the exact same sentence. Am I missing something? 3 years, 6 months, 5 years, 9 months, 5 years, 9 months. Bifurcated into 18, 24, 33, 36, 33, 36. And at the bottom again, it says concurrent, concurrent, concurrent. But the difference is in that one, she's not eligible for the challenge incarceration or earned release program. So I'm trying to figure out whether I have the right documents here. They look similar.
Third amended judgment. You have a second amended judgment of conviction, which is at page 129.
Okay.
Which is subsequent to the amended judgment that Justice Zito had.
That's why I was asking if there were only two. Or there's a third one then.
This is the same thing.
It says the same thing. That's why I raised the question with you that the only difference in the amended judgment, the amended statement in the transcript, is the extra 9 months for count. Is it three? Is that right?
Well, does it say the exact same thing?
Yes.
Yes.
Because then there is no extra anything, and I'm wondering why we're here. Other than what was said on the record doesn't reconcile with the actual judgment.
You see, count two is supposed to have count two is supposed to have 69 months as amended in the prison. Other than that, the judgment as stated by the judge, is the exact same as I read it. That's why I'm raising that with you, and I'm looking at page 119 of the red brief. In other words, we're having a little trouble. We're having a little trouble reading this.
Well, I mean, the time is identical, and they all say concurrent. So with respect to your arguments and what the actual judgments of conviction say, they're kind of missing each other, I think, which is why I'm bringing it up. Because in all three documents, the one from May,
right,
the one from July 7, and the one from November 17, whether it's the initial judgment of conviction, the amended judgment of conviction, or presumably the second amended judgment of conviction, they all call for the exact same sentence, except for the earned release and risk reduction, you know, and challenge incarceration program. And they all say concurrent.
Right. And these sentences, all the sentences were to be concurrent to the Waukesha County conviction. The only difference was...
But the point is, if that's true, the very first sentence and the very third sentence, the only difference in the judgment of conviction is the eligibility for the risk reduction, I'm sorry, the challenge incarceration and earned release programs. Did you realize that?
When I'm looking at page 129... The month increased to 33 months from the 24 months, which was the initial sentence that he gave the defendant. So on count 2 and 3, initially he gave her 24 months in incarceration.
Okay, if you look at the very initial judgment of conviction back from May 13, 2011, what does it say? I'm just trying to figure out if we're working off the same song sheet.
Right.
That's all.
And no, I agree. It does say 33 months. So.
Yeah. So how does that work for your argument with respect to whether the judge made a verbal error considering, or who made the error?
In other words,
they all three say the same thing except for the challenge incarceration program and earned release program. They all say concurrent, and they all give the exact same sentence, whether it's judgment of conviction 1, 2, or 3. I'm sorry to do this to you.
No.
I kind of am, but I'm kind of not because we have to know what we're talking about. I'm not trying to be mean or put you on the spot. I'm just trying to figure it out.
What controls? What's said in the transcript or what's said in the documents?
Mr. Haskell, perhaps we could call your client.
there is case law that says there is case law that answers that question of what controls when the judgment, whether it's in civil or criminal, conflicts with what was said on the transcript. What controls? I think it's the transcript, but I'll have to take a check.
I'm sorry, and I don't know the answer to that question.
But if a judge were to see a judgment of conviction that doesn't reflect what's said on the transcript, what should a judge do?
Recall the case, and this is my intent.
No.
Before your time expires, I do want to ask you, Gritzmacher relied at least in part on DeFrancesco. And I asked Mr. Haskell about DeFrancesco. Did you read the portions? I'm sure you have. Are you familiar with the portions, pages 132 and 133 that I referenced earlier? I'm sorry, 133 and 134, where Justice Blackmun goes on at some length describing at page 133, historically the pronouncement of sentence has never carried the finality that attaches to an acquittal. And then he goes on, just to try to hurry this along, he goes to the historical, the history of resentencing, and it says that so long as resentencing took place during the same term of court, in 1789, it was acceptable. Now, I disagree with Mr. Haskell's reading of the case, and he can correct me if I'm wrong or show me where I'm wrong. Blackmun then goes on at page 134 to sort of note as a collateral matter, this accounts for the established practice in the federal courts that the sentencing judge may recall the defendant and increase his sentence. I'm not sure if that's the statute he was referring to, but it looks to me like Blackmun relied more on the historical nature of the difference between recalling a defendant or retrying after acquittal versus retrying after sentencing. And when I read that, I thought, well, that would be very helpful to the state, and I didn't see it argued in the brief, and I'm wondering why. That's my question.
Right. Well, I think in State v. Martin, it was the first case when the court called into question the limits or the scope of DeFrancesco. In this court, in Gritzmacher, I think the holding in DeFrancesco was, it could be argued that the only issue was whether it was relevant to a federal statute that allowed the state to appeal. But I think in Gritzmacher, this court said, no, it does apply to the cases where, absent a federal statute, a trial court increases a sentence after a defendant has already begun serving it.
Did you Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
A general rule, which is followed until we don't, is that appellate courts should decide cases narrowly. And if you can decide it on a state issue, a statutory issue, then, and it's not necessary to get the constitutional issue, then it's asserted that that's the way to do it, because it's the narrowest. Should we look at the issue of reflection first, since that apparently is not a constitutional double jeopardy question?
I think reflection is a factor that can be considered in addition to the Jones factors. I think you can look at what the record, you can look at the time it took for the court to resent, and you can look at to whether the trial court impermissibly reflected.
The amicus brief starts, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm saying the amicus brief starts on the very first page that there are limitations other than constitutional limitations. That's in the first paragraph. And the second paragraph said the law in Wisconsin bars Wisconsin circuit courts from increasing sentences based on mere reflection. In fact, it goes on to say that in the next page or two, that you can't decrease on mere reflection. You just can't change on mere reflection. And so that's the law, and that cites the increase and decrease. Wench is the case cited where you can't decrease either on mere reflection. So should we tackle this case on what might be non-constitutional grounds first?
Well, I think the court in Burt and Grootsmacher talked about reflection. I know Burt did for sure, and what you can discuss is, you know, this, well, the state's argument is that there is no reflection. I do think this court should address that issue because prior cases in the appellate courts have discussed in the double jeopardy context whether the trial court impermissibly reflected in imposing a sentence.
You think we should continue that law on reflection? That's your reflection.
Yep.
Thank you. Counsel? I'm sorry.
I am not clear about this statement. The state indicated initially a recommendation, but that's been altered. Was that recommendation with some different times involved, also for concurrent to everything that happened in Waukesha County?
Wasn't that the 11 months that Mr. Haskell was talking about previously?
I don't know if that... I don't know. I don't think that they were concurrent to Waukesha. Got it somewhere. I know that he stated the sentence correctly, that there were two that were going to be concurrent to each other and consecutive to the third count. But when I read the plea agreement, I don't think it said that it was going to be concurrent to the cases in Waukesha.
There's a reference here to Judge D'Amato's recommendation makes sense by defense counsel. What is Judge D'Amato's recommendation?
I'm sorry, can
you? Let's see. On page 107 of your appendix, Mr. Ripple or Ripel or.
Okay.
Judge D'Amato's recommendation makes sense that she needs treatment. Is that a sentencing recommendation?
I think because Judge D'Amato revoked her probation and sent her to prison, I think that was the context of that, is that she's going to get treatment in prison.
Okay. Is there a PSI in this case?
I don't know. I don't know.
Do you have any idea if this defendant is serving the sentence currently
on
the amended judgment of conviction that only says it's concurrent?
Yeah, I checked on CCAP on Friday, and she is still serving the sentence.
But, I mean, the only thing that's a judgment of conviction is for a concurrent sentence.
Right. I mean, I do know that she's still serving until November of 2013. and then she will go on extended supervision.
Okay. Your assumption, then, is that she is serving the modified sentence.
That is my assumption, yes.
That is your assumption.
Yes.
And I gather, and I will ask the defendant, that his assumption is that she's serving the modified sentence. Otherwise, we shouldn't be here because there is no double jeopardy because she got the same sentence the second time. Isn't that right?
Right.
Okay. But you do have a slight problem, I think, that the judgments of conviction in the defendant's brief, three of them, seem to have, at least at my reading, the same sentence given, and that the difference is, as I read it, the comments as to the case of risk reduction are different in the three convictions. And the difference in the three convictions is how much credit she gets.
Right.
For several ones, she gets 100. For the first two, she gets 111 days credit. And then the third one says 77 days credit. Now, that credit is not an issue in this case, right? And credit is either given or not given and doesn't raise double jeopardy. That's a separate, right? Okay. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Haskell? Why do you think your client is serving on a modified judgment?
Yes, as to these judgments of conviction, the first judgment that was ever entered, an actual formal judgment of conviction, was in fact the one dated, I believe, May 13th is the first date, and that reflects the 33 months in confinement. That was the first judgment of conviction. The second one, after the Department of Corrections authored a letter noting that she was not eligible for ERP or CIP, she was made ineligible. And then the last one, as the Chief Justice noted, related to sentence credit. And this gets to, I believe, what Justice Bradley noted, a question, unfortunately, I do not have the case law at my fingertips for it, but that the oral pronouncement controls over a written pronouncement of sentence. And so that's how we have a validly imposed sentence on day one.
Except, as Justice Ziegler caught this, it's unknown to me what's on CCAP and what she's serving, and if she's getting out in November, which one is it on? Is it on the transcript or is it on the judgment of conviction?
And CCAP does not look at the transcripts. CCAP gets the judgment.
That's why it's reduced to writing. So the only thing reduced to writing reflects a concurrent sentence. Are you
it's
sure?
It's always been a concurrent sentence. Even on day one, Judge Van Grunsven imposed a concurrent sentence. It's just a matter of 24 months of initial confinement on counts 2 and 3 versus 33 months of initial confinement on counts 2 and 3.
But even the first one says 33.
The first judgment of conviction does. Yes. No judgment of conviction was entered formally until after the second sentencing, until after the resentencing had taken place. That's why there's no actual judgment of conviction reflecting the May 10th sentence.
Okay, so consecutive versus concurrent is not an issue here?
Consecutive versus concurrent is not. The judge at the original sentencing on May 10th imposed a concurrent sentence, and on May 11th, when he increased the sentence by 9 months, it was still concurrent. He just extended it. He made it 9 months longer.
As to count 2 and 3?
Correct. Those are the battery to officer counts.
That's right. So count one was the same.
Correct.
First day, same. Second day of sentencing.
Yes.
This is quite clear as he states it on page 119, that this is on his second day of sentencing, and he explains he's dealing with counts 2 and 3 and giving it a 69 months. And it doesn't matter whether he calls it 2 or 3 because it's all concurrent, right? So he's got 69 months. That's line 14 and line 18. And in the first sentencing,
that number was 60 months. But otherwise, as I compared them, they were otherwise exactly the same. This is not a concurrent consecutive. It's upping the number of months.
Correct. Yes.
You just answered the question. You finally put it to bed, and that was there was no initial judgment of conviction that reflected the initial sentencing. The first judgment of conviction reflected the amended the second day, the bring back sentence.
That's correct. But the first pronouncement of judgment was for this shorter sentence, this 24 months of confinement. And I think in the state's argument, it seems that, you know, I think that the parties are seeing eye to eye as far as the test to apply as it comes to, I think the Jones factors are still the guiding principle of the rule that I've proposed. It's simply in the application of those factors, we wind up in a situation where this defendant can legitimately expect that the sentence is final because there was no error of fact, error of law. The state notes this, the Grootsmacher case, and the fact that, you know, it went at length to point out prompt, you know, resolution of errors, and that's correct. But that defendant also was sentenced on an incorrect understanding of the law that was clear from the record. At the sentencing hearing, the judge imposed a 40-month sentence saying, I think 40 months is the minimum amount of confinement that is required for you, and so I want to impose that. But unfortunately, the judge inadvertently imposed that sentence on a count that called for a maximum of, I think, 2 years. So it exceeded the maximum pretty clearly. So the judge needed to recall it and fix that. I think that the Willett case from the Court of Appeals highlights where an error is still, even when there is a legal error, sometimes time trumps. The court had indicated it wanted to impose consecutive sentence but didn't believe he was able to, and then imposed a concurrent sentence, thinking that's what he was required to do. I think that if that judge had called Mr. Willett back the next day, he wouldn't have been able to legitimately expect that sentence was final. It would have been a prompt resolution of something that the record indicated was an error. But the court waited 4 months. And so I think at that point, the Court of Appeals concluded, well, hold on. At that point, a defendant can expect, you know, finality.
Just so we're all on the same page, counsel, and I'm going to take you back to where you started rebuttal. It was the court's explanation. Consecutive and concurrent comes into play because it was the court's explanation on May 11th that he misheard the recommendation as being consecutive. He said, it was my mistaken impression that she, the ADA, said the 9 months was consecutive and tacked on to the 24 months. So in order to, his explanation then, was in order to give effect to what he, on May 11, understood the plea to be, he added 9 months. That's why we go from 24 to 33.
I think he understood the plea, I think, all along that was in this case. What he misunderstood was the Waukesha sentence.
Right. But that's how consecutive and concurrent comes into play. Is that
right? I think that's why those, you know, phrases are kind of in this case. But otherwise, I think it had always been concurrent sentences were imposed in this case. And as well, I only wanted to correct one thing. Record item number 8, page 4 of that, is a recitation of the plea agreement before it kind of got muddled and changed. And it does indicate that all sentences will be concurrent to the Waukesha sentence. And so, again, we'd only ask that this court, in applying those Jones factors, when the original sentencing record does not reveal any error of fact, error of law, misconduct by the defendant, that the defendant can legitimately expect that that sentence is final and not subject to subsequent increase. Thank you.
Maybe the test should be there's no expectation of finality until the judgment of conviction and sentencing is filed in court.
It's a possible rule, but I think that that's inconsistent with the double jeopardy law. I think that gets closer to a time-based analysis where a defendant has a sentence imposed that, again, is facially valid in every respect, and the defendant is, you know, has to be told by, you know, defense counsel, you know, this is the sentence you got, but, you know, it takes the court 2 days to put together a judgment of conviction, so don't start counting your chickens yet because this will come up, because there's nothing in double jeopardy that would prevent that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank both the counsel for their briefs and their oral argument on yet another double jeopardy case in this court, and so ends our hearing on 11-AP-2833, State v. Jacqueline R. Robinson. The court is in recess until 1:30, when it will hear its third case today.